Hi, I'm Mike Dilk and you're listening to the Relax Back UK show, the show that explores all kinds of health topics relevant to you, your family and your friends. Each week I talk to expert guests from a range of backgrounds to inform and entertain you. So please do join the Relax Back UK family and stay tuned.
Hi, and thank you for joining me on the Relax Back UK show. The first subject today is a very alarming one and something that needs some serious attention.
Around 70% of 18 to 24-year-olds have either experienced or witnessed drink spiking. And I was on Good Morning Britain this morning talking about it. And even Ranveer came forward to say it had happened to her, which we didn't even know about. So I think, you know, everybody either has a story or knows something that has been spiked.
The topic is drink spiking. I chat to Ashley James, a DJ and broadcaster, and Mark Ackred, founder of Counter Spike. Then I learn about motor neuron disease.
Motor neuron disease is essentially the motor neurons that connect the sort of the brain to the muscles. They carry the signals from the brain to sort of make the muscles work. And essentially, motor neuron disease describes when those motor neurons break down and don't start working as well as they should. And that's a gradual progression.
My guests for that are Richard Evans, director of engagement for the MND Association, and Zoe Nixon. She was diagnosed with MND in 2022. Please do stay tuned for a great show. But also, remember, if you're listening on UK Health Radio, there are very many other useful and fascinating shows to take in. If you're listening via the schedule, after this show, we have the sports doctor, Dr. Bob. He's been a guest on the Relax Back UK show and is a wealth of knowledge, and he'll be chatting about irritable bowel syndrome, so do tune in to him after the Relax Back UK show. But now, stay tuned for a great show. Thank you.
This show is cool!
For the drink spiking topic, I started off by outlining my experience of the subject, which I have to say is pretty minimal.
I'm old, right? I'm 59. In my 20s, spiking a drink was putting a little bit more vodka in it, or something like that. But this whole spiking is a whole new phenomenon, really, isn't it? So what's going on, and just kind of how widespread is it? Either of you?
Well, if I can speak a bit from my personal experience, I'm 38 years old now, and I started going out much too young, around 14, 15, and spiking was definitely something that I was very aware of. So for me, this doesn't feel new. It's definitely been a threat and something that I've worried about throughout.
And threat is the right word, actually, I think.
Yeah, definitely. So it's something that even now that I'm closer to 40, I still am really conscious of when I'm out and about. And obviously I'm a DJ, so I spend a lot of time in kind of like nightclub settings. But I think what's really important to point out is it's not just nighttime nightclub settings where spiking occurs. It's in local pubs, house parties, it's anywhere. And it also doesn't just happen in alcoholic drinks. So you could go out and drink soft drinks and you could still be at risk of having your drink spike. And I think something that I'd like to highlight is often we think of spiking as something that happens just to young girls, but actually this is something that we've seen is happening to men, boys, older women, and a lot of the time the reason behind spiking could be because of pranks, especially around younger boys.
Yeah, I wanted to ask that. What is the objective here? Is it sexual assault? Is it theft? Or is it just done by moronic people who think it's funny?
I think all of the above. And I think that's why it's worth mentioning, you know, especially like for older people, there are cases where people are spiked so that they can be mugged. It obviously puts you in a very vulnerable situation. And I think, you know, whether you're listening and you're going out, even if it's just to your local pub, or whether you've got children and you've got a son or a daughter, maybe going out for the first time, going to pubs, going to festivals. I think, you know, everything that Mark is doing in creating these amazing products to try and hopefully keep us safe.
Yeah, I definitely want to talk to Mark about what he's doing. But before that, what is it that gets put in drinks? I mean, if I wanted to spike a drink, I wouldn't know where to start. What's going on? Mark might be better to answer that. I don't know.
Sure. It's changed over time. So historically, it was more Rohypnol, but most recently, the most common drug used is ketamine because it's so readily available. You won't have had to look too far back in the press to realize that there's a lot of ketamine that was brought into the Netherlands that then suddenly disappeared, a number of tons. And it's very cheap. So it's sort of £20 for a gram. And you don't have to put very much in it to people's drinks. So that makes increases the chance of people actually using it because they might only have to put, £3 worth of that drug in your drink to spike you. So it's affordable is the
Interesting.
wrong word, but do you know what I mean? It's easily accessible.
Yeah. Okay. So if you're in that business and you know where to look, you can get this stuff to spike people's drinks relatively easily. Now, Ashley, you mentioned that it's kind of all age groups, men and women, and all sorts of venues. Is it across the whole country? Is this everywhere, or is it particularly
It's
bad in London, or
globally.
what's the deal?
Globally, I've got friends. One of my friends had a really horrific experience with spiking on the other side of the world in Australia. It's up and down the country. As I said, it's clubs, it's bars, it's festivals, and it's so widespread that around 70% of 18 to 24-year-olds have either experienced or witnessed drink spiking. And I was on Good Morning Britain this morning talking about it, and even Ranveer came forward to say it had happened to her, which we didn't even know about. So I think, everybody either has a story or knows
Yeah.
someone that has been
Well,
spiked.
I have a vested interest in this. I've got a 20-year-old daughter who's
Yeah.
just she's just done her first year at university, and she talks about it like it's just part of everyday life of being a student. It's not a one-off surprising event. It's something that she's very aware of, and I'm glad she's aware of it, but I'm horrified she has to be.
Yeah, and I suppose the issue is that, these are the statistics that we have, about 6.6 million people being spiked, but actually, we think an estimated 90% of drink spiking incidents go unreported. So lots of times I think it's easy if you are spiked, you might doubt yourself, like you might question whether maybe you had too much to drink, maybe you didn't have a big enough meal, like you wonder whether it actually happened. And I think now that we've got these counter stick, they're like tests that you can put inside your drink that will tell you if they are if your drink has
I'm
been
going to ask
spiked.
Mark lots of questions about that, but I have one question actually about avoidance actually. Do venues, do pubs and clubs have a responsibility? Because this is going on their watch, on their property. What can they do? Can they get involved?
So it's interesting, actually. So in LA, in the States, every single licensed premises now has to have some form of test within it to be for their insurance to be valid. And we don't yet have that in the UK, but I do think.
So a test like you supply, the kind of dip
Yes,
in and see if
exactly.
it's okay, all
Exactly
right.
like that. So you have to be able to go to the bar and get the test if you want to have a test. We don't have that in the UK yet. But I think that we should. And Counterspike's actually doing an accreditation program. So if the venue's staff have been trained, and if they have information about spiking, and if they have tests available, behind the bar or in the loo or wherever it is, then they'll become Counterspike approved, and then they will drop into our app. So if you're around, you can very quickly see
Yeah.
either from our app or from a sticker in the window, like a food hygiene certificate, that those tests are available. But I think it's really important. I think it's important that the drinks companies, collaborate on this. And I'm talking to a number of CEOs at those companies about doing something and making it available to all.
Yeah.
But as
Well,
Ashley
talk.
said, it's not just, it's not just the bars and venues.
Now, well, talking to my daughter, she says simple things like, well, actually, having lids on your drink and the opportunity shelves in toilets so you can take your drink to the toilet, stuff like
Absolutely.
that, simple things.
I think look, it's not just one solution fits everything. It's about working together, whether that is drink caps or tests or looking after your friends or having a, and I think that shelf in the loo is a brilliant idea. Obviously, you're still slightly susceptible, but I think all of those things together will reduce spiking. And that's what our main aim is. We want to change this from it being epidemic levels. And as Ashley said, you know, it's a global issue. I've been speaking to everyone this week, from the Philippines to South Africa to Canada and America. It's everywhere. And even in South America now, drugs are being used to spike tourists so that they can then rob them. So it's a properly global issue.
That's an old story. That's been done, years gone by. But I suppose if it's now easier with certain types of drugs, it's just more prevalent. Yes. All right, so we've talked about what venues can do. What about the individual? You've got your test. We can go out with some of these things in our top pocket. Describe what your test is a bit.
Sure. So we have a tube. It's a very similar size to a lipstick. It has 10 single use tests in there. You literally pull out the test, and there's a yellow section on the test, which is effectively the chemistry. And you dab your finger in your drink, you dab it onto the yellow section, and then there's a color code on the tube, which you hold it next to it. And if it matches the light orange or the dark orange one, then your drink has been spiked.
I told my daughter that I was going to be talking to you guys and that there was this test available. And the first thing she said was, well, you know, most of the clubs I go to, you won't be able to see that. It's dark.
I mean, yes. So
we've all got phones.
Yeah, exactly.
We've all got phones. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. Yeah.
Exactly, actually, yeah. We've all got phones, and they've got a white light on them, right? So actually it shows up really well.
Okay. All right, so these kind of dipper test things, are the young people take, and old people, I suppose, it's relevant to old people, as Ashley said, but young people, are they taking them on board?
You know? Yes. So I did a festival, small festival in Leeds about a month ago, and we had a spike detecting trailer there, and people could come up and use them and either, you know, sample them or buy them. And 50% of everyone there came to us to get some and to use them. And we were testing people's drinks for free there. Mm. And what was really amazing was that even men came up to us, and they were incredibly grateful because they've got sisters or daughters or mothers.
Yeah, that's me at the minute. I'm worried about my 20-year-old.
Well, exactly. And it was brilliant to see it. And that one of the other interesting comments that they made was that they feel slightly, as students, they feel slightly abandoned. They feel like this is a massive issue, and there's a lot of talk about it, but there's not necessarily that many solutions. And I think that's critical.
Well, that's keen, actually. That's the next topic I was quite keen to talk about. Have any culprits been caught? You know, have they received anything more than a slap on the wrist? And it kind of has the law caught up with, you know, people talk about law not catching up with technology. Well, this is a slightly different situation, but has the law caught up with this kind of change in behaviour?
It's in the process of catching up. So there is a bill which is in Parliament at the moment, which is being reviewed, and that will make spiking a specific offence. Until this point, actually, it's been more about the secondary offence, you know, whether that's rape or robbery or whatever it might be. So yes, it is catching up. But my background, I was actually a barrister, and even if you've got the law, you still need the evidence. And even if you've got the evidence, you still actually need the prevention, because the issue here isn't just about getting the perpetrators, which is critical, but it's also about avoiding that anxiety for those people. And if someone has been spiked, and Ashley was with Rachel this morning at on Good Morning Britain, and the anxiety after having been spiked sticks with you for years. And yeah, that's the issue. And as well as obviously preventing by the threat of law, we should actually prevent by, you know, technology, whatever that may be. But it is getting there, and it is good. And that will also, you know, reduce hopefully the number of people. And they're talking about, you know, severe sentence for it. But again, a lot of these people doing it are young. Do they know whether there's a law or not? I don't know. My view is that education here is the critical thing from a very young age.
Yeah, I mean, sorry, go ahead, Ashley.
I was just going to say, I think as well, like for me, from personal experience and from experiences of my friends, often if we suspect that we have been spiked, we might not come forward either to the venue or the police, because we like doubt ourselves or we're worried about victim blaming. And I think the great thing about these tests are that obviously we can have them on us to protect ourselves, but also like friends or even people that we come across in toilets if they feel unwell. And it hopefully will allow, I mean, I guess number one, it's a deterrent, isn't it? Because if you're going to spike someone's drink, but you know that there might be these tests around, you're hopefully less likely to do it. But also if you're able to prove to a venue, you might be taken seriously more because I think, you know, lots of times, sadly, people might just assume that you're drunk. But if you can show that, look, this test is showing that I have been spiked, then obviously hopefully we can start to track perpetrators because they might be able to see them on CCTV or there might end up being an emerging pattern. So yeah, I think it's a really positive step, but also most importantly, it's hopefully talking about spiking reminds people to never leave your drink unattended and to always try and at least like leave it with a friend.
I mean, all this does alarm me because, you know, because we're getting at the symptoms, like the overall cause of, you know, there's a much bigger social issue, which is which I, as a dad of a 20-year-old, I would like to be solved. But, you know, I live in the real world and we've got to chip away at these symptoms. I read an article, I remember it was a few months ago, about something that I found hard to believe. It was cases of spiking, but not putting drugs in people's drinks, but people actually been injected with the hypodermic in a club. Is that still a thing that's happening?
Yes. Well, it's just, I mean, there's a massive issue in France, wasn't there, the other day with, I think, 80 people being needled in a club. I think the thing it is increasing, but I think it tends to gather more attention because it's a, you know, it's an even worse invasion of, you know, of someone's personal space, isn't it? And it's very difficult to deal with that. However, that said, there was a case in Scotland, I think a few years back, where they thought they had a case of someone going around needling everyone. And actually it was someone going around with a compass, you know, like an old school compass, and just jabbing everyone. So they thought they'd been needled. Right. So, you know, there's some slightly moronic individuals out there. And that is an issue. And it's not an easy, very easy one to defend against. You know, you can have metal detectors and things, but people can hide needles anywhere now, can't they? It's, you know, it's not difficult.
Goodness me. I mean, just an example, I keep coming back to it. But recently with my daughter, we went to a family wedding. And afterwards, she said it was so nice to be at a party with a drink and not have to worry about spiking. You know, you could put your drink down, you could go to the toilet, you could chat with everyone. And she said it was such a different environment to when I, you know, go out with my university friends where you have to worry about this. And they all do worry about it, which I suppose is a good thing. But the fact they have to worry, you know, I'm not on board with, but I'm glad she is aware. Final question, I suppose. If you are out and you suspect that your drink has been spiked, or one of your friends has been spiked, what can you do? What should you do next?
Well, I think, as Ashley said earlier, the one of the benefits of the tests is that actually it can take you down an entirely different path. And what I mean by that is, if you think you've been spiked, or if your friend has been spiked, and you then test the drink after they think they've been spiked, you can then go with some authority to the venue owner or whatever, whoever's there, and say, no, actually they have been spiked, they're not just drunk. And that just takes you down an entirely different path and gains the seriousness that it needs. So I think that's a critical factor. I think then you've obviously, so we're actually finalizing the development of an app, so you can put all of your friends in. So you put your five friends in that you're out with that night. There's a big red button. If you get spiked, you hit that button and it sends a what three words location as to where you are, if you're in a bigger than a bar, and it sends a checklist of what you need to do. And that is along the lines of, take them to a safe space, make sure they're fine, give them some water, inform, you know, the venue owners, inform the emergency services, you know, but make sure most importantly that you stay with them, because it's, as Ashley said earlier, it's the vulnerability. And often, you know, if you get kicked out of a club and you've been spiked and people then just think you're drunk, and then you get left. The other problem is you can't always get into a taxi because, again, they think you're drunk. So yeah, we are
they don't
working.
Want drugs in their taxi.
Exactly, exactly. And so, again, we're working with some of the taxi companies so that if you can show that you've been spiked, then at least you can prove to them and then they will take you home. And I think that's a huge part of it as well, because it's all about safety at the end of the day.
It is about safety, but does the app also ping the police so that, you know, they can say, right, I've just been spiked. It's someone in this club now.
Yes, so they can do, and we will have a heat map which we can share, which will show if there's something particularly going on in one area. So actually, if there's 5, 6, 10 people that are there, then we can see that that's becoming a hotspot. And that would be, you know, that would be great. The other thing is, obviously, by virtue of the fact that you've hit the button, it will time and date stamp it. And then if there is CCTV, then you'll be able to see, you know, OK, you'll be able to look through the CCTV at that time and that point.
What kind of delay is there from your drink being spiked to you having a drink to you thinking, goodness me, something's not quite right?
Broadly speaking, it obviously depends what drugs have been used, but, you know, 0 to 20 minutes.
Okay, so it's pretty speedy.
Yeah, I mean, I was spiked at a festival with both my children about 4 or 5 years ago, and it was a slight wine tasting in a tent at a festival, and I just had a sip of the wine. You know, there was only a small amount in there, and within sort of 15 minutes, my head was lolling, and I had to go outside. And within 20 minutes, I was lying on the ground and don't remember anything after that.
And that a wine tasting. Okay, this is
It's like a sort of white, like a fun wine tasting in the middle of the day, and so the glasses were left on the side for the first drink. And so you just went and picked up your drink. And so obviously someone in there for fun had put something in one of the drinks just to randomly, you know, select. Like, so, and that was horrific because, you know, obviously I was with my children. I was the parent in charge of the children. I wasn't able to look after them. And that's had a huge, you know, net impact on them. So my daughter is at an age where she can go to, you know, to these festivals that there are this summer, and she's not that keen on going.
Right.
But all of her, you know, her friends are. And that's because she's seen, you know, the person that's supposed to be sort of looking after them in control, not in control. And the other problem was that everyone, you know, was walking past me, assuming I'd had too much to drink. And then were sort of looking at me with utter disgust that I had two children with me.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I can imagine. Goodness me. Right. This is obviously a big issue. We're not going to solve everything in one 20-minute chat. But if people want to find out a bit more, you know, what we've been talking about, what you can do, tests you can get, how you can take steps to avoid issues, is there a sensible kind of source of information that either of you can suggest?
Yes. So We've got counterspike.com, which is our website where you can obviously access the sticks, but we've got a lot of blogs and education on there. We've got lots of blogs about, you know, for parents, you know, for their children going to festivals or going traveling. And we've got what to do, you know, what to do if you have been spiked. And we also tie up with a charity called Spike Away UK, where they deal with a lot of post spiking incidents. So they offer help and, you know, consulting or whatever to help the parents or the victims of spiking.
Goodness me. Okay. Anything to add, Ashley?
No, I just think it's a really exciting product, certainly one that I wish was around when I was younger. And I think for so long, people have known about spiking and have felt kind of that, you know, you have to wait until something really bad happens before it's taken seriously. And like for me personally, you know, my children are still really young, but I certainly will take solace in having these with me to protect myself and for friends, but also when my children do start to go out, it's nice to know that there is a product that can like help them. And as Mark said, like have authority to go, whether it's to police or to venues, to say like, this is real and it's happened and I need help. So, you know, sadly, I wish that we didn't need this product, but sadly we do.
Yeah. Okay. No, this is an important subject. So thank you to both of you for taking the time to chat. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Anne and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries
and cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
The first question I asked my guests about motor neuron disease was, what exactly is motor neuron disease, and is it a term for a number of different diseases?
Motor neuron disease is essentially the motor neurons that connect the sort of the brain to the muscles. They carry the signals from the brain to sort of make the muscles work. And essentially, motor neuron disease describes when those motor neurons break down and don't start working as well as they should. And that's a gradual progression. In terms of is it one disease or is it lots? That's actually been a debate in the scientific community, and I think it's really emerging that it actually is a lot of different types of disease all sort of under one umbrella, in the same way as for example types of cancer are actually lots of different diseases within that type of the body. It's a similar thing, so we call it one disease, but actually there's lots of different things going on within that.
Okay, so and research is ongoing really to kind of really nail down the answer to that question, I suppose, is that right?
Absolutely, and we've been frustrated by the slow progress in terms of research into new treatments. But actually, there is now one type of motor neuron disease where people have a specific genetic change, where actually there is now an effective treatment that we're trying to go through the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence to try to get it approved. Okay. And that's really effective. But actually, that's only effective for 2% of people with MND. So just this particular type, and we're hopeful that shows a real sort of proof of principle that actually is something that is possible to treat. Now we now need to develop the ways of treating the other 98%, and we understand much more about the biology of the condition than we ever did before. So really using that knowledge to develop those new treatments that everyone in the community wants us to do.
Okay, I'm definitely going to ask you more about treatment, etc., that sort of thing. But perhaps now, we could just concentrate on symptoms. Mm-hmm. So maybe this is a good opportunity to bring Zoe in. You were diagnosed relatively recently. How did it come about? You know, how were you aware that something wasn't quite right?
It was a very long, slow process, which was a bit clouded in my judgments because I'd had previous spinal operations and I was still in recovery for that. So I wasn't sure if it was spinal issues and it was affecting my body or this is something new. I was in rehabilitation in a spinal unit, and I told the doctor, my hands keep locking out when I'm eating, when I'm holding a pen, or when I'm grabbing things like turning the tap on in the kitchen. And he kept looking and checking, and he said, I'll refer you back to the neurologist. I thought, because it's taken nearly a year to recover from the spinal stuff, that maybe it was carpal tunnel from using my laptop in bed or excessive use of the phone.
Right.
And it took nearly a year to diagnose that I definitely had a form of motor neurons disease.
And is that quite common, that it takes a while to diagnose?
Yes, very common. They have to eliminate everything else they could think it could possibly be. And the signs are very subtle at the beginning, so that hand locking and spasms could mean a lot of different things. It's only as it progresses over the time when other things will come up, like the twitching calcifications, is when your muscles just twitch on their own. and you can feel them moving. And there's a wobbling of the tongue if you look in the mirror. That's a really classic sign. You can see it looks like worms run to your tongue. You can't feel it, but you can see it in the mirror.
And so are symptoms, are they well defined, or do they tend to be sort of quite specific for different people? You know, so it's hard to pick up on.
As it progresses, it's easier to pick up when they have electronic tests, which will define that the muscles are actually dying and they're decreasing. But yeah, it's normally within, I think there's three sets of motor neurons disease. One is a bulbar start, where your voice will start to go, your voice box. And that would be the first sign, where mine was my hands. So it's called limb onset. And Richard, what was the, is there another one?
I'm not sure the definition, but I think it can affect different parts of the body. So if you think of it as being a breaking down of the motor neurons between the brain and the muscles, that can really depend wherever your body relies on muscles. And I think one of the issues around diagnosis is how long it can take, and lots of people tell us that it takes them too long to get diagnosed, and that actually it can be an extremely difficult and arduous process to go through that process of finding out what's wrong with you. And one of the things that we're doing, both from a health policy perspective, is to try to make that journey easier to get an answer than it is at the moment.
Is there a specific test? Like, is there, if you know, if you're suffering from this hand locking thing, is there then a blood test which you can take, answer yes or no?
No. So it's, as Zoe says, like that it's more about eliminating all the other things it could be to get to the diagnosis. Right. One of the things we want to do in terms of our research is to find a better way of diagnosis. And it would be brilliant to be able to get to a point where there is a test that we can do very easily, because that's one of our sort of research priorities to actually how do we make sure we can really clearly and categorically diagnose it very, very simply. And that's a work in progress, and we don't have it yet.
Okay, all right, well, good luck with that. But what about causes? You know, is it down to genes? You know, you're just unlucky in your genes, or lifestyle, or does no one really know what actually causes this thing?
So there's some types of MND that are very, very clearly genetic, and like I was saying with the new treatment that is effective for the 2%. That's 2% with a specific genetic change. Where there's others that are called sporadic, and we don't know why they've happened. Realistically, like many diseases, we don't fully understand why MND occurs in people, but that it's likely to be a mix of genetics and environment in some way. But we're not really we're not at the point where we've got clear sort of this causes it and this doesn't, in the same way as for other diseases. So that again is a work in progress in terms of better understanding exactly what it is that increases or decreases risk.
Okay, I mean, for some diseases, you can say, you know, like cancer, for instance, you know, if you smoke or if you drink, it could move in that direction. Is it the same with MND, or just, you know, you're not that far advanced at all?
So we don't sort of have a really clear view. So one of the things that's been talked about a lot is professional sports, and whether that sort of increases risk, particularly sports with where there's impact. But again, there is evidence, for example, that seems to be pointing in the direction that could increase your risk. But we're really not sure. So there's much more research needs to be done on this sort of thing.
Okay, right. We've covered a few things, but we haven't yet moved on to, you know, what you can do if you're diagnosed. What treatment is there? Is there treatment available? I suppose the ultimate question is there a potential cure? You've touched on that a little bit, but you know, what can you do if you're diagnosed with it? What's the next step?
There isn't a next step at the minute. That's a problem. You can try as hard as you can to get on some drugs trials, but unfortunately, like for me, I have been under drugs trial for 14 months, but the criteria is very strict. And if you've had the disease more than 2 years and it's a slow progressing, which I am, then you're not able to get on a lot of the drugs trials. there was a lot of work going on in the background, a lot of trials going on, but unfortunately, there's just nothing has happened for the MASH yet. Like Richard said, the 2%, which is a family gene, SOD1. Yeah. They have a treatment for that now, which is amazing, and just hoping that we'll find something soon for everyone else.
Okay. So the treatment really is help with the symptoms currently. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, there's help for your symptoms, obviously aid, so chairs and feeding tubes if you need those later on, and painkillers, muscle relaxants, things like that, but nothing actually treating the disease.
Yeah, there is just one treatment that people with MND take, and that's called Riluzole, and that is it's something that's been available for many years, but while it can extend life, it only does it by a modest amount, so it's not so you might, for example, see that extend life by a few months, but it's not the effective treatment that we're looking for. And as Zoe says, that is there now for people with that specific genetic change, and you know that 2%, and that is the goal, is to get that kind of treatment and that kind of, you know, impactful treatment for the other 98%. I should also add that one of the things to echo what Zoe said, that a lot of people with MND tell us is that actually they struggle to get onto the research trials, and you know, that's really important to people, because if they're trialing a new treatment, then the hope is that might have an impact. But people are struggling to get onto that, and that's why we as an association are funding a program of research nurses to essentially work with people with MND to try to get them onto appropriate trials more so than is happening today, and we hope that can make a difference to more people getting onto the trials that give them a hope of a treatment.
Yeah. Okay. Good luck with that. I mean, as far as progression of the disease, does that change from person to person, and even do you have, you know, periods of time when things progress very slowly, and then symptoms might get worse for a while, and then you stay on another plateau for a while? How does that work, Zoe?
Yeah, for me, luckily, I have been a slow progressor. My hands are affected, my arms, my neck. It's very hard to hold my head up. I have slight breathing issues. And little bit, tiny bit in my legs, but I'm really lucky. And yeah, I think it does, I don't know if it platters out, but you sort of feel it when the next thing drops. So one day you'll try to do something, you'll go, I can't actually do that. It's very subtle. Mm-hmm. I can't pick something up, or that really hurts to do that, or I can't bend and get this over. But that I'm very slow, where I've had people that I've met at the beginning of this disease, they're no longer with us. So it really, really does depend on the person on which MND they have and how it affects them.
Goodness me. One thing it mentioned in the press release, it talked about the financial considerations, you know, of having a disease which, you know, carries on for a while. And very often you can't work. What's the situation with you, Zoe? Are you able to work?
Again, I'm very lucky, because I've heard a lot of stories where they're not so lucky. I had my own business that I worked from home, so I could do a lot with the computer, and I still can. And I've changed my model of working, and closed it, parts of it down, and just doing a small part, so I'm keeping myself busy. I'm in a position where I can look after myself at home and do some more fundraising and raising awareness. So that's my goal. But for the people that haven't got that luxury, are in a really diabolical place, really, the amount and thousands of pounds it takes to adjust your home. I can't turn the key in the door because I haven't got the strength to put it in. And that's scary, not being able to get out or in your house and things like that. And to change that, it was thousands of pounds. And to get ramps put on, to get wheelchairs, to have a bathroom, a wet room. And that's just the beginning. There's so much you'll need later on. And a lot of people don't have that luxury, unfortunately.
Right. So one thing, actually, this was in the news yesterday. And Richard might be able to comment, because, you know, I'm sure you help people with these kind of issues. But they were talking about changes in the PIP rules. What does PIP stand for? personal independent payments? Are changes in that likely to be relevant, Richard?
Yes, yeah, so one of our concerns is that will impact on people with MND. And as Zoe says, that lots of people are impacted financially very significantly. And we as an association do give financial grants, but in terms of the scale that we're able to give people those grants, that they're not able to sort of meet that financial need. And Zoe mentions about housing adaptations. You know, we hear horrific stories about people who essentially end up being trapped in their homes because the council isn't quick enough at processing their application for a housing adaptation. And that's something we're going to be campaigning on later in the year, because people really need the changes to their housing when they have that need, and they cannot afford to wait. And so it's really important that the government is more receptive to that. And I think the other thing to say is that as well as that having motor neurone disease can actually increase your bills. So a lot of the equipment people rely on uses up more electricity. So energy bills can become more expensive. But then you've also, for many people, you've got the sort of double effect of the person with MND having to give up work, but then also another wage earner in the house will also have to give up as they take on caring responsibility. So it can have a really devastating financial shock. And at a time when people are getting, you know, trying to get their heads around a really devastating diagnosis, having that financial impact on top is just something that really isn't acceptable.
Okay, no, I get that. I think the final question, if people are worried, they've got symptoms which they're, you know, have started to feel, like, you know, locking of the hands and maybe dropping things, and they're a bit concerned, what should they do? Can they get help from their GP, or what's the best way forward?
Absolutely. If anyone's got any concerns, you know, go to your GP and talk to your GP about them. Also, people can go to the Motor Neurone Disease Association website. So that's mndassociation.org. And we've got a section on symptoms so people can sort of get that information to make sure they're understanding what the symptoms are. But absolutely, it's about talking to your healthcare professional and getting their advice.
Yeah, and you mentioned a good source of information and help just then, a website. Mention that again, Richard.
So it's mndassociation.org, and that's the Motor Neurone Disease Association website, and that contains information right across the board on all aspects of MND.
Excellent. All right, look, Zoe and Richard, thank you very much indeed for taking the time to chat, because, you know, this is obviously a very important topic for, you know, a significant number of people. So many thanks.
Thank you very much to the guests on this week's show. And they were Ashley James and Mark Ackred talking about drink spiking, and then Richard Evans and Zoe Nixon talking about MND. Thank you to you for listening, and have a healthy week until next week.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
If optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list, then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one super supplement brand, help you achieve that in the most convenient and comprehensive way possible. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, sleep, emotional balance, and more. Benefit from the power, purity, and positivity of our award-winning powder sachets or our therapeutic capsule range. Use code RADIO15 at reviveactive.com and save 15% off today. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio, the
The station that makes you feel good.
Thanks for listening to the Relax Back UK show. Join me, Mike Dilk, again next week for more fascinating interviews and chat. If you're listening to the podcast version, please subscribe, like, and share it with your family and friends. And have a healthy week. Until next week.